when the vote on same-sex marriage came to the floor of Parliament, we wanted to make sure that there was going to be a Parliament that was going to vote in favor of our rights.
Tim Miller was doing a performance workshop, and it was Performance All Our Lives. And I took it, and it was amazing. It was one of those watershed moments that change your life.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Equality enhancements march with pride around the world, marriage rights seem safe after Canada's close call elections, and a lesbian performance artist explores revolutionary highways. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Rick Watts.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 3rd, 2004. This week marked the anniversary of the 1969 Stonewall Uprising, generally viewed as the beginning of the modern lesbian, gay, and transgender civil rights movement. When police attempted a then-routine raid on the New York City bar called the Stonewall Inn, the patrons fought back, soon joined by hundreds of others as word spread through the community. The event's anniversary was observed with marches that began the tradition of Pride celebrations. Pride parades and festivals have now multiplied into the hundreds, spreading to nations around the world and most months of the year. But the last week of June remains the peak of the season, featuring many of the oldest and largest events.
There is a new element in New York City's massive Pride March this week. For the first time, police officers involved in the 1969 altercation were part of the parade, at the invitation of some of the same gay men who had struggled with them. Organizers estimated that 1.5 million people turned out to watch the long parade down Fifth Avenue. Amid the party atmosphere of colorful costumes and dance music, marchers' signs and badges signaled their demand for equal marriage rights and a desire to oust its opponent, Republican President George W. Bush, in November's elections. Pride Week in New York also featured the first graduation ceremonies for Harvey Milk High School, the city's pioneering public school specifically serving lesbian, gay, and trans youth. For New York City's elected officials, including Mayor Michael Bloomberg, participating in the Pride Parade is practically a requirement. But this week, the city council added more substantive support, voting more than 10-1 to override Bloomberg's veto of the Equal Benefits Bill, which requires companies contracting with the city to extend any spousal benefits they offer to their unmarried employees' domestic partners.
Just as venerable as New York's march is San Francisco's Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender Pride Parade. Organizers dedicated this year's celebration to the memory of Gwen Araujo, a Bay Area teen who was brutally murdered 2 years ago by three men when they discovered the beautiful young woman's male genitalia. That slaying raised the level of public awareness and activism on violence against transgenders. Last week, the suspect's high-profile prosecution ended in a mistrial as the jury split between charges of first- and second-degree murder. A court this week approved Araujo's posthumous legal name change from Eddie to Gwen Amber Rose.
This week's San Francisco parade featured many of the more than 4,000 same-gender couples who obtained marriage licenses and married there before the courts intervened. Their contingent generated a lot of emotion and roars of support for the man who instigated the licensing, non-gay parade Grand Marshal Mayor Gavin Newsom, and its chief defender in the continuing legal battle, City Attorney Dennis Herrera.
And there's a little more hope for marriage equality in the U.S. as a federal appeals court this week rejected a challenge to the nation's first legal same-gender marriages in Massachusetts. The first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals denied a claim brought by several conservative legal groups on behalf of the Catholic Action League and 11 state legislatures that Massachusetts' highest state court, the Supreme Judicial Court, overstepped its authority in deciding last year that gay and lesbian couples have the right to marry.
About 1 million people attended Toronto's 24th annual Pride Parade this week. It took place on the eve of national elections that had been called the most important ever for the lesbian gay community, and it showed. With the long-ruling Liberal Party vulnerable, fears ran high that the Conservative Party would take over, and Tory leader Stephen Harper had indicated his readiness to override the Charter of Rights, if necessary, to stop marriage equality. It was a significant issue in a sometimes ugly campaign. Despite Pride Marchers' urging, voter turnout was at an all-time low of 60%, but the election results were quite favorable to the community. Even though the Liberals lost about one-fifth of their seats in the House of Commons, they remain the largest party. But they no longer hold a majority there, so even though Prime Minister Paul Martin believes he can run a minority government without establishing a formal coalition, they'll require allies to advance legislation. The much more solidly gay-supportive Bloc Québécois and New Democrats, and both of those parties gained more parliamentary seats. The Conservatives remain the largest opposition party.
There was a crowd of more than a half million for Berlin's 12th annual Pride March, which was led by openly gay Mayor Klaus Wowereit. Germany's National Social Democratic government made a tangible gesture this week, announcing a bill to allow same-gender couples who've legally registered their partnerships to co-adopt each other's children. There was immediate vocal opposition to the move from the Conservative Christian Democrats and Germany's Roman Catholic Bishops' Conference.
In Paris, some 700,000 people watched openly gay Mayor Bertrand Delanoy lead thousands of Pride marchers. Their slogan was, "Enough hypocrisy, equality now," expressing resentment of the French government's vigorous and continuing opposition to the recent marriage of a gay couple by a mayor. But last week, the same government gave them something to celebrate, as the cabinet agreed on a bill to criminalize incitement to discrimination, hatred or violence against a person on the basis of gender or sexual orientation. If enacted, it will provide for punishments of a substantial fine or up to a year in jail.
Legal recognition of same-gender relationships advanced this week in Spain and New Zealand. Spain's lower house took a preliminary step, approving a non-binding resolution calling on the government to open civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples. The new socialist government is already working on legislation, with Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero strongly and repeatedly advocating for the move. His justice minister said this week that a bill could be introduced in September and Spain's first same-gender marriages could take place early in the coming year.
New Zealand's lower house had already given preliminary approval to the Labour government's civil unions bill. But this week, members of parliament gave an even larger majority on the first reading to its more powerful companion measure, the relationships bill. The Relationships Bill is an omnibus measure to overhaul about 100 existing laws and regulations to end all discrimination based on marital status, treating marriages, civil unions, and de facto unmarried cohabitants equally.
London's Pride March this week was characterized for the first time as a parade rather than a demonstration. Yet it was dedicated to the memory of Jamaica's leading gay activist, Brian Williamson, who was brutally murdered in June. And it came at a particularly bittersweet moment for Britain's Anglican gays and lesbians, as openly celibate gay Geoffrey John was ceremonially installed this week as Dean of St. Albans Cathedral, one of the highest posts in the Church of England. John had been appointed to serve as a bishop, but was forced to withdraw before his consecration for the sake of unity within the church. Conservatives claim that despite his long abstinence from sex, he's disqualified by his failure to repent and his vocal support for equality. Even as St. Albans' deanship has already caused one cathedral official to resign and two local parishes to withhold their contributions to the diocese. But this was also the week when Britain's long-awaited legal reforms to recognize transsexuals in their self-identified gender passed their final stage of enactment, winning the Queen's royal assent.
Still very much a political demonstration was this week's third annual march in Calcutta, demanding equality for India's sexual minorities. Some 300 marchers braved the cold hostility of passers-by in a conservative city, in a nation where sex between men remains a criminal act.
And finally, top officials from around the globe gathered in Jakarta this week for Asia's biggest periodic conference on security issues. But tradition dictates that on the last night of the meeting, the dignitaries perform to entertain each other. Perhaps it was all that pride in the air. The Associated Press reports that five U.S. delegates appeared as that uniquely American phenomenon, the Village People, the 70s disco group who played gay, even though most of them weren't. A staunch opponent of President Bill Clinton's move to open military service to gays and lesbians when serving as chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, President Bush's Secretary of State, Colin Powell, took the role of the hard-headed construction worker to dance and sing the classic YMCA.
It's fun to stay at the YMCA. It's fun to stay at the YMCA.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 3rd, 2004. Written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Rick Watts.
A lesbian cultural worker says that the arts are not icing on the cake, they're essential. You'll meet her to find out why later in the program. With the future of same-gender marriage hanging in the balance, Canadian queers were particularly anxious as the country headed into its June 28th federal elections. Financial scandal had the governing Liberal Party plummeting in the polls, and it looked as though victory might go to the newly minted Conservative Party of Canada, the product of a merger between the Progressive Conservatives and the notoriously anti-gay Canadian Alliance. Equal marriage activists worked tirelessly to expose the extremist viewpoints lurking behind the Conservatives' moderate veneer, and in the end, as Heather Kitching reports, their efforts paid off.
It's the evening of June 28th, and Vancouver's Fountainhead Pub is hopping. If you didn't know any better, you could be forgiven for thinking that there was a good game on TV. Actually, the Fountainhead is in the heart of Vancouver's gay village, and tonight, the queers are here to watch the results of Canada's federal election.
Queers were really anxious about this election because...
Mary Wu Sims is the former chief commissioner of the BC Human Rights Commission and a spokesperson for Canadians for Equal Marriage.
We have two vacancies on the Supreme Court, with a third expected to become vacant sometime in the fall, which would have to be filled by the new government. So it was going to be extremely important to get a Supreme Court that would be a fair court when it came to looking at the question of same-sex marriage, but also subsequently when the vote on a bill on same-sex marriage came to the floor of Parliament, we wanted to make sure that there was going to be a Parliament that was going to vote in favor of our rights.
Same-sex marriage is currently legal in three Canadian provinces. A bill to legalize it right across the country was drafted by Canada's previous Liberal government and sent to the Supreme Court of Canada for approval. That hearing is scheduled for the fall. Once the government had the court's decision in hand, the plan was to introduce the bill in Parliament. However, had the Liberal government not been re-elected, that plan may have changed quite drastically.
Before the election date, there had been polls that were showing that the Conservative Party, which would be a right-wing party, mainly opposed to LGBT rights, were going to be leading a minority government. That was going to be very concerning for LGBT people because there were some powerful members of Parliament from that party who had made extremely anti-gay comments. One of the members of Parliament basically said, to heck with the charter, to heck with the judges. If we ever come to power, we would make sure that gays and lesbians didn't have these rights because we've gone too far socially progressive, and it's time we reined the courts and the charter in. So a lot of people were really freaked out by that.
In the end, the queers watching the election at the Fountainhead had something to cheer about. The Liberals won 135 seats in the House of Commons. Enough to remain the government, but not enough for a majority. They'll be forced to govern in cooperation with the New Democratic Party and the Bloc Québécois, both of whom are even stronger supporters of same-sex marriage than the Liberals. Minority governments such as this are not known to last very long in Canada, but queer activists are hopeful that it will last at least long enough to pass the same-sex marriage legislation. They predict that with the current composition of the House, the votes are there for passage.
I think we can take a measure of relief from the fact that Canadians seem to have rejected the social conservatism that was being espoused by the Conservative Party.
Meanwhile, the election was also a good one for queer candidates. The only loss for a queer candidate in this election was, surprisingly, that of Glenn Murray, the openly gay mayor of Winnipeg. Montreal's Réal Ménard, who's openly gay, and Vancouver's Libby Davies, who's openly bisexual, were both re-elected with significant margins of victory. But perhaps the most poignant victory went to Bill Sixay. For 18 years, Sixay was an assistant to Canada's pioneering gay politician, Sven Robinson. Robinson tearfully resigned as an election candidate earlier this year after admitting to stealing a ring from a jewelry auction in a state of emotional distress. Sixay stepped in to fill Robinson's shoes and ended up coming out victorious.
No, I'm very excited. It's not where I expected to be standing tonight, and I still have to give my head a shake every once in a while, but it's great. Sven called me earlier to wish me all the best and congratulate me, and we just had a quick conversation, but he was very excited about the results tonight.
For This Way Out, I'm Heather Kitching in Vancouver.
Hola amigos, this is Luis Alfaro, performance artist, playwright.
This is Monica Palacios, Aztec God, Fajita Combo. You're listening to This Way Out,
the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
Arts funding has always been a bone of contention in U.S. politics, and queer artists have frequently been accused of using government money for indecent purposes. But the programs that brought lesbian performance artist Danielle Brazel from a rough neighborhood of Southern California's San Fernando Valley to the highways of social change could not have had a more wholesome impact. That's what got This Way Out correspondent Nancy Beverly interested in Brazel's story.
I've asked Danielle Brazel, performer and recent artistic director of the performance venue Highways, to step outside the office of her day job in the Mid-Wilshire area to pretend we're back in her Valley childhood neighborhood.
There's a string of ran-down apartment buildings that are kind of barricaded with wrought iron, and then on top of that is barbed wire.
So take us back to the tough 14-year-old. What was she interested in back then?
Smoking a lot of pot. Getting by, trying to negotiate the neighborhood, the constant drama that went with the neighborhood, and kind of keeping the family together and moving forward.
So I wanted to know, how did Danielle Brazel go from a disadvantaged kid to a performer and artistic director of a renowned performance venue? We head back inside, and I ask if she saw any theater when she was growing up.
My earliest memory of seeing a play was we got the opportunity to go downtown to the Amundsen, and we saw this play called Bugs, and it was all about bugs, and I was so excited because there was a cockroach, and we had many cockroaches, and the cockroach was actually very, very cool. It was like he had a New York accent and the whole thing. You know, we saw the play, and the actors came out and spoke with us afterwards. We got book bags, and it was just one of those magical moments where you're like, I want to do that. That's what I want to do. I don't know how I want to do it or what I want to do in it, but this is where I want to be. We actually had many, many opportunities because this was, of course, in the 70s, and there was many educational programs for youth, for disadvantaged youth or whatnot. So we were always on a bus going somewhere, and those experiences absolutely shaped my life and my future.
Danielle also participated in a program sponsored by UCLA that brought disenfranchised kids to camp, and there she was able to start creating plays. But she still didn't know what she wanted to do with her life. She didn't even have a sense what 18 would look like. Her next moment of clarity came when her friend Chuck Stallard, a photographer and visual artist, invited her to Highways.
He had a show in the Highways Gallery, and we worked at this horrible photo lab in Burbank. And I was in my 20s and very just frustrated all around. I didn't know how to get to where I wanted to go and didn't know where I wanted to go.
Danielle is looking at Chuck's display of baseball cards that examine the homoeroticism of baseball, plus she's investigating the cement floor of the Highways lobby, whereupon Chuck had started the tradition of writing names of friends and loved ones who had died of AIDS.
So while we're watching this floor, he says, you know, you got to be careful because there's a workshop happening just on the other side of the curtain. And Tim Miller was doing a performance. It was a CAC, a California Arts Council, sponsored workshop.
and it was Performance All Our Lives. And it was a mixed gendered workshop surrounding AIDS. Anybody could attend. It was open on Saturdays from, I think it was 2 to 5. Chuck said, oh, you should take it, Danielle. You would love this. You always said you wanted to be in theater. And I took it, and it was revolutionary. It was amazing. It was one of those watershed moments that change your life. I don't know how I mustered up the confidence to actually do it, but I think I was so frustrated that there was an opportunity and there was a place. And when I walked into Highways, I remember thinking to myself, I want to be here. This is the kind of work that I want to be involved in. It's relevant. It's doing something. It's making a difference.
That performance class with Tim Miller, who was one of the original co-founders of Highways, taught Danielle a lot about herself and others.
God, I learned so much. I think one of the things, aside from kind of performance techniques, was being able to trust my instincts and to know that my story was important, and that it wasn't just important for me to tell my story for me, but it was important for other people to hear it, that it fit into a larger cultural framework, that people didn't have that information. So my voice became information for people, and it became an active dialogue. I needed to, as a white, not even queer yet, identified person, to know that my experience was valid and that I could make work about that experience that would help transform the way other people thought. What I also learned was through the many other people who were in those workshops who taught me who they were and how their experiences fit into a larger cultural context.
From the very first class, Danielle dove in. She started volunteering at Highways and eventually became its house manager. Soon, she started working with a performance ensemble called the Sacred Naked Nature Girls, which gave her yet another incredible opportunity to explore.
It started with 5 women on stage with only white light, no really theatrical lighting. We wanted to keep it pretty clear for people to see the lines of women's bodies because we were naked from the beginning to the end. The work really used flesh memory, the memory that we hold in our bodies through generations, through our DNA, through our histories, a concept that Akilah Oliver had been developing in performance quite a bit that we were exploring. A lot of work about being gay, being straight, being attracted to each other, work around racism and the duality between S&M bondage and the connections to slavery, women's bodies inherently having the connection with rape and incest and abuse, as well as pleasure. And where are those intersections? We were much more interested in the intersections and the discussion. We didn't have the answers per se, but what we did is we created a forum of investigation, and we took the audience on that journey.
Danielle's further evolution was nudged along by artistic director Tim Miller, who was often challenging her to do different things.
Tim and I would have these meetings at the beach, at his little spot in Venice Beach, and I'd go over to his house and we'd go for a swim and have a little lay, and, you know, not a lay, but like we would lay out in this. That's funny. And Tim and I would lay, and, you know, he would kind of say, you know, I think it's time for you to start teaching, Danielle. And I'd be like, oh no, I'm not ready for that. Oh no, I think you'd be a really good teacher. And I'd say, okay, well, let me think about it. You know, another time he'd say, you know, I think it's time for you to start curating. I think that'd be a really good move for you. What do you think about that? Would you want to put something together? You know, maybe one of your, you know, a dyke night or a girl night. Like, I don't know. Maybe let me think about it. And I'd always come back around going, yeah, okay, I'll do that. That sounds good. And I had left the house manager position and was primarily just performing with the Sacred Girls and exploring my own solo work and having girlfriends, which was really fantastic. Tim came up and he said, you know, I think it's time for me to transition, and I'm just, you know, curious to know if you would be interested. I think you'd be really good at it, Danielle. And I said, oh, I don't know, Tim. That's really, you know, it's a big job. I don't know. So, well, let me think about it. And I said, you know, I thought about it. I called him. I said, yeah, I think I would be interested.
That was in 1999. She and Tim served in tandem for 6 months until Tim stepped down and Danielle became the sole artistic director, a post she held for the next 4.5 years. And of course, she continued to grow.
I learned what I could do when I put my mind to it. I didn't have that confidence. I didn't have that self-esteem before. I didn't have the tools. I was actually functioning illiterate. Up until 10 years ago, I couldn't write a simple sentence. And yet I found myself with a group of people that respected my opinions, my ideas, my values, and also challenged me. There was an alignment for me of those values. Tim Miller, Jordan Pimer, Nicole Werner, 18th Street, Highways, the Sacred Naked Nature Girls, the hundreds of artists that came through that space that I was able to study and watch and learn from, Guillermo Gomez Pena, Coco Fusco. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. The Five Lesbian Brothers, these are all people who absolutely informed who I was and how I was shifting.
Recently, Danielle realized, as much as she loves presenting other performers, she wasn't feeding her creative side enough and felt the need to get back to that. So last December, she stepped down from Highways. She is now working on a new performance piece and facilitating Queer Exchange, part think tank, part performance workshop for 18 to 25-year-olds, both gays and their straight allies. Queer Exchange is funded by the L.A. Cultural Affairs Department, which was almost eliminated in the name of saving a few bucks for the city. A close call, and it would not have been a good move in Danielle's eyes.
The arts are not the icing on the cake. They're essential services, and it's really about quality of life. You know, for myself, being a recipient and not having access, I don't come from a culture, I don't come from a family that went to the theater, that went to the arts. Who knows where I would have been if I didn't have access, if somebody didn't, you know, show me that.
Didn't put you on the bus and take you down
exactly,
to...
Exactly, if I didn't meet the cockroach. If I didn't meet the cockroach changed my life, you know, and how many more?
Queer Exchange will help young performers see how the mass media is trying to construct an identity for them. And the exchange will help them call their own shots, something Danielle Brazell learned to do at Highways, her home for 10 years.
Being at Highways really taught me to come into myself, to find my way of being queer. And having that room makes all the difference in the world. Having that room to really, truly craft who you need to be in this world is one of the greatest gifts. And if I can bring that to another generation, then I feel that I'm able to really make a difference and continue my work in performance.
This is Nancy Beverly. Oh.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Rick Watts, Graham Underhill, Fenceberry, Rex Walkner, Heather Kitching, and Nancy Beverly contributed program material. Margie Adam and Talking Heads performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime, online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by grants from Clarissa Pinkola Estes, La Sociedad de Guadalupe Foundation, and the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Only you can help keep this program on the air, and you can get some queer history, music, and culture on specially produced CDs in the bargain. For all the details, please log on to thiswayout.org or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on Contact FM, Hamilton, New Zealand, WGDR, Plainfield, Vermont, KXLU, Los Angeles, California, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we know you'll stay tuned.